I invite Meg Gillard to come and share the scripture with us.
This is from Matthew chapter 5, verses 38 through 48. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give them your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also the second mile. Give to everyone who begs from you, and do not refuse anyone who wants to borrow from you. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and on the unrighteous. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brothers and sisters, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect.
So I understand that the virtual online debate of this past week is what we do with our airplane seats. Have you heard about this online thing? Well, there's a video because a woman on a plane tipped her seat back, as you're supposedly allowed to do, and the guy behind her got annoyed and started bumping her seat over and over and over and over and over again. The latest I saw, she's now planning to charge him with assault. She captured it all on video. So the question is probably less, what do you do with your airplane seat? But it rises to the larger question, which is, what do we do when we have conflict with somebody else? When someone literally invades our space? When someone figuratively invades our space? When people annoy us? When people hurt us and do things that wrong us? In this collection of teachings we call the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus gets very practical, very down to earth. In fact, the old Southern expression might be, he stops preaching and goes to meddling. I've already talked with the young people about some of what he tells us about anger. And then he goes on to talk about other conflicts and how we respond. As I said last week, for those of you who are here, Dr. Glenn Stassen, who is a Baptist professor of ethics, has described what he calls a threefold structure in Jesus' teachings in the Sermon on the Mount. First, there's the traditional wisdom, often framed by, you have heard it said. And second, Jesus points us to the problem, living out that wisdom, the vicious cycles we get trapped in. And then Jesus suggests transforming initiatives, ways out of the vicious cycles, possibilities for change, to alter relationships, to find our way into God's realm of love. So the traditional Jewish teaching on conflict was an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. This was actually a teaching about proportional response, about not escalating conflicts. And it was seen as an improvement over what often happened then and still happened now, which was something starts small and keeps blowing up. Even today, a proportional response is lots better than escalation. But Jesus saw the vicious cycle, tit for tat, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. It's still about revenge, about justice based on making the other person hurt as much as you hurt me. As Gandhi famously said, an eye for an eye leaves the whole world blind. Jesus offered transforming initiatives, ways out of the cycle of revenge. But too often, the cultural specifics of his examples make us miss the point. These examples are not about just being passive and submissive, not about letting other people run you over and boss you around. Just as we so often mishear the word meek in the Beatitudes and think that just means be timid and passive, we can mishear these teachings. What gets translated as do not resist the evildoer is better translated, I've learned, do not resist with evil means. Don't use the same methods. The word resist here apparently implies aggressiveness. So turn the other cheek is not about letting someone just beat you up. In that culture, folks say, you would never touch a person with your left hand. That's true in some places in the world still today, where I grew up in Bangladesh. So you would only touch a person with your right hand. And with the right hand, a master might slap a servant with the back of his hand on the right cheek. Notice he says, if someone slaps you on, or hits you on the right cheek. So they might slap them with the back of their hand. That was allowed. That was considered an okay way for a master or a person with superior status to discipline someone. Now, we may have our problems with that, probably do, but in that day, it was okay. However, if that same person turns the other cheek, then they force the person, if they're going to hit them again, to hit them with the front of their hand. And that was considered the way you would hit an equal. So, turning in the other cheek was a nonviolent direct action, a way to claim your equality and challenge the other person to consider what they are doing. You might get hit again, but it would be as an equal, and they would know it. The example for suing for the coat and cloak is also full of cultural stuff that doesn't make sense to us. Again, in that time, a poor person could be asked to give their outer garment as a guarantee on the loan of money. But the person, the richer person, was supposed to give it back every evening so they wouldn't be cold at night, so they could still wrap up in that outer garment. But if the richer person took them to court to sue for their inner garment, which is what he's saying, then they would literally be trying to take the shirt off your back, the clothing that the only clothing the person had. So Jesus said, okay, they take you to court. They're trying to treat you that way without any mercy, without any kindness or justice. Take it all off. Give them everything. Strip down, naked, bare-chested, right there in court. Show their unkindness. Show their injustice. And again, in that day, to be naked in public, to show your bare chest, was not acceptable. I mean, it would cause a ruckus even in court here today, I think, if someone started stripping off their clothes. But certainly in that day, it was a shameful thing. You would expose the rich person's greed and lack of mercy. And then walking the second mile was about a response to the Roman occupiers. Some of you may have heard this. A Roman soldier was allowed to force a Jewish man to carry his pack for 1 mile, but only a mile. But Jesus said, take the transforming initiative. Keep on walking. Go another mile. Who knows? It might create the possibility for conversation. If nothing else, the soldier will be surprised and you get to explain why you're doing it. Maybe there's a chance there to change the relationship. And it certainly changes the power dynamics. And then that difficult one for me, which is give to anyone who begs to you. What do we do with that? With homeless people, drug addicts, people we expect are using drugs. And yet I think Jesus' call is to generosity, to find ways that are less about, not about judgment, to trust God with the outcome. So all these examples are very culturally conditioned, but the principles hold true and they're powerful. It's about transforming initiatives, about finding ways that claim our equality, that expose injustice, but in nonviolent, loving ways, not in revengeful, vindictive ways. It's about finding our ways out of the vicious cycle of revenge into possibilities for reconciliation and restorative justice. No one can control how others will respond, but we can control how we act. We can claim our soul power, our inner strength, and our worth as human beings. This is about nonviolent direct action, about using the spiritual power of love to create new possibilities of relating. What a powerful witness we have to these teachings when we think about the civil rights movement and the work of Mahatma Gandhi and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Building on these teachings of Jesus, these 20th century prophets took the principles and the power of these transforming initiatives and created movements that use these principles to change societies. Whenever I read these verses, what comes to my mind is black students sitting in at lunch counters at whites with a whites only sign posted, resolute, disciplined, as people spat at them and yelled at them and screamed at them and police officers dragged them off to jail and more students silently filed in and filled the seats. I think about people marching, young, old, even children, heads up, faces forward, arms linked, as other people scream at them and the dogs bark and the fire hoses blast. This was the power of nonviolent direct action that Jesus taught them. We know what it means because we have seen its power. We have seen what it has done in our society and across the world when people claim their power, claim the power of love and nonviolent action. Dr. King loved to tell the story of one elderly woman in Montgomery. Months into the bus boycott, when the folks had been walking day after day after day after day for miles because they knew the bus system was unjust. This older woman had walked for miles to her job as a maid for a white family, and the organizers became more and more concerned about the impact it might be having on her strength and her health. So they said, "Let us try to get you a ride. We'll arrange a ride for you." And she said, "No, I don't want a ride. I want to walk." They said, "Aren't your feet tired?" And she said, "Yeah, my feet are weary, but my soul is rested. My feet are weary, but my soul is rested." She had found her soul power. She had found the transformative power to do something that made her feel at peace. Yes, her feet were tired. Yes, it was hard. Yes, it was challenging. But she had claimed her dignity and worth as a child of God. and she wasn't going to stop until justice was done. Jesus went on to say, "You've heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your heavenly mother and father. For God makes the sun rise on the evil and the good, sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what's the reward? Everybody does that. Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly God is perfect." Well, the perfect trips us up, doesn't it? We know we can't be perfect. What if we hear the word more as whole, complete, fulfilled? All those meanings are in the word. Be more whole. Be more complete. Be more who you were meant to be by living this way that God calls you to. Love your enemies, I think, is perhaps the most radical of Jesus' teachings. To practice forgiveness, to pray for those who hurt us. And yes, I talk with the young people, it's hard. It's nothing easy about it, and you have no control on what you're going to get back. There's no guarantees that loving your enemy is going to change them. If you're like me, you may have grown up thinking you should not have enemies, right? We're supposed to love everybody. I don't have any enemies. It was a great comfort to me in seminary when I started looking more closely at the Psalms and realized how many enemies the psalmists rage against. The main thing I remember from my pastoral care class in seminary was I got to claim it was okay to be angry, that anger had its purpose, and my choice was what to do with it. Jesus is honest. We all have people who feel like enemies. Maybe not all the time, maybe just some of the time they feel that way, but in the moment, sometimes long moments, they feel like enemies. They're acting as enemies, working against what is good for us. We heard a lot last week about the National Prayer Breakfast and our president's response. But I think it's worth our while to take a minute to actually pay attention to what was said by Arthur Brooks at the prayer practice. He's a sociologist and a committed Christian. And in his speech, he diagnosed our national problem right now as what he called political contempt. He said that the 19th century philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer described contempt as the unsullied conviction of the worthlessness of another person. Contempt is seeing the one we disagree with as inferior. Contempt is the opposite of respect. And contempt eats away at any possibility of relationship. Brooks quoted a prominent marriage therapist who says, based on research, that the best predictor about whether a marriage is going to end up in divorce is if you start seeing more and more contempt between the two individuals. Brooks believes that we have in America today a crisis of contempt. And in response, he calls for what he says is moral courage. In a free society where you don't fear being locked up for your opinions, true moral courage, he says, isn't standing up to the people with whom you disagree. It's standing up to the people with whom you agree on behalf of those with whom you disagree. Brooks went on to challenge us, his hearers, to do three things. Ask God to give you the strength to go against human nature and to follow Jesus' teachings and love your enemies. Ask God to remove political contempt from your heart. And then he said, make a commitment to another person that you're going to do this. Ask another person to help hold you accountable, to reject contempt and seek to love. And third, he said, go out looking for contempt so you have the opportunity to answer it with love. You know, we know the immediate response that Brooks got at the prayer breakfast. The president said he wasn't sure he agreed with him. And how do we respond to that? Do we respond with contempt? With judgment? Or do we step up and try to live with love? The way of compassion, standing up for those who disagree with us, praying for them. And let's be clear, praying for them is not just praying that they'll see the evil of their ways and be like us, right? Praying for them means praying for their good, wanting God to bless them. In these times we live in, this can be hard work, but it's the way out of the vicious cycle. It's the way out. It's the way toward love. And let us not forget, as we seek to do this, the power of the witnesses from the civil rights movement, from so many other times in human history when people have chosen love over hate, chosen compassion over contempt. Dr. King wrote that we are called to love that is an overflowing love, which seeks nothing in return. It is the love of God operating in the human heart. And when one rises to love on this level, one loves people not because you like them, not because their ways appeal to you, but because God loves them. When one rises to the point of loving the person who does an evil deed while hating the deed that the person does, this is what Jesus meant when he said, love your enemies. Dr. King went on to say, I'm really happy Jesus didn't say, like your enemies. Because it's difficult to like some people. Like is sentimental. It's pretty difficult, he said, to like someone bombing your home. It's difficult to like someone threatening your children. It's difficult to like someone working against your efforts for civil rights. But Jesus said to love them. And love is greater than like. Love is understanding, redemptive, creative, seeking goodwill for all people. So how do we get there? How do we get out of contempt, the cycle of contempt and revenge? Jesus is very clear, very specific. Take transforming initiatives. Stand up for those we disagree with in conversations with those we agree with. Pray for our enemies. Someone I read this week said they have committed to pray every day for some public figure they disagree with. Well, we have lots of opportunities for practice, don't we? Dr. King said, darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. Let us commit ourselves again to the way of love, the way of wholeness, the way of compassion, the way of God that Jesus showed us.